Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu,
with a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening.
Be gracious to me, O Lord, for I'm in distress. My eye wastes away from grief. My soul and body also, for my life is spent with sorrow and my years with sighing. My strength fails because of my misery and my bones waste away. I am the scorn of all my adversaries, a horror to my neighbors, an object of dread to my acquaintances. Those who see me in the street flee from me. I've passed out of mind like one who is dead. I have become like a broken vessel, for I hear the whispering of many, terror all around, as they scheme together against me, as they plot to take my life. But I trust in you, O Lord. I say you are my God. My times are in your hand. Deliver me from the hand of my enemies and persecutors. Let your face shine upon your servant. Save me in your steadfast love.
Farther along the wheel, know all about it. Farther along the wheel, understand why. So cheer up, my brothers, live in the sun. Why the good man dies, the bad man thrives, and Jesus cries, 'cause he loves them both. We're all castaways in need of rope, hanging on by the last threads of our hope, in a house of mirrors full of smoke. Confusion, illusions I've seen. Where did I go wrong? I sang along to every chorus of the song that the devil wrote, like a piper at the gate, leading mice and men down to their fate. But some will courageously escape the seductive voice with a heart of faith, while walking that line back home. So much more to life than we've been told. It's full of beauty that will unfold and shine like you struck gold, my wayward son. That dead weight burden weighs a ton. Go down to the river and let it run and wash away all the things you've done. Forgiveness, all right. Farther along we'll know all about. Farther along we'll understand why. So cheer up, my sisters, live in the sunshine. We'll understand this all by and by. Oh,
question that I found as my unique self that has been at the center of what I would say is my faith journey. I didn't always know that, and I think, at least as far as I can tell, that it started to form in me in a way that would surface when I was in seventh grade. Because that's when we read Diary of Anne Frank. And the question for me is, how can a person possibly trust a God who allows suffering. Now, when they handed out the book, and I can remember, I'm a visual person in that way, so it was red, hardback book, and it had Anne Frank's picture on the front. And I was excited. I knew nothing about it, but I was excited because it was a diary, and I really liked those kind of books, you know, memoirs and diaries and letters being written back and forth. Little did I know that I would read this book and feel crushed. And at the time, the way I knew how to come up with a question in class and at home is more like, it sounded more like this. If God is so good, then why did Anne Frank die? And why did 6 million Jews plus homosexuals and gypsies also get put to death in a systematic way, right in front of people and the whole world in World War II? That's what I knew. Well, some years later, when I was in high school in the 70s, I'm 54 now. So it was in Berkeley. And as you can imagine, the AIDS epidemic was hitting our world. And as you can imagine, I was in high school, and we spent a lot of our party time. My mom's in the room. She didn't know this. Now she finds these things out in worship in the Castro district across the bay. And so, sorry, Mom. And not sorry, just sorry I had to say that in worship quite like that. These things happen. And we would go over to the Castro district. And I was surrounded by people who had AIDS, who were suffering horrendously. And the fear was rampant in our community, in my high school. And I kept thinking to myself, what did any of these people ever do in their life to deserve this kind of fear and suffering? Well, by the time I got to college, which was at San Francisco State, I realized, looking back, that I was still really working on this question, because I chose to be a U.S. history major with an emphasis in World War II and the Holocaust. That's where I spent my time, with a minor in women's studies. After college, Mark and I started dating, and we got married. His parents were both artists. I never met his dad. He died before we got married. The artists, Arn and Catherine, they lived really on the edge, and they were faithful people in their own way, trusting that to be an artist, to put their whole lives on the line like that, and to think that they could raise a family and live off their art, that's an amazing way to trust. And in the midst of that, Mark's dad got sick, diagnosed with a brain tumor, and he died at the age of 44. Fast forward some years, we were married, and we were working our life plan, or my life plan, which meant babies now, and none of that worked out either for me. And what I mean by that is, when you suffer from infertility, you don't expect it, and it happens, and then it took really 10 years to get child number one here, and many years to get child number two and number three onto this earth. All of that is to say, my suffering felt absolutely like persecution. Why wouldn't my body do what it seemed to me like everybody else's body did, every other woman's body did, naturally, with no problem? It was difficult. Little by little, over all of those things, what I realize now at this stage of my life is that my worldview has been shaped. And my first question was really a huge one. World War II. Masses of humanity and their behavior. And I got a little older, and it moved closer with my surrounding community of the Bay Area and how we lived life together there. And then finally, right to the heart of my being, suffering, sadness, frustration, anger. How does suffering happen to innocent people? How does suffering happen to anyone? Why does suffering happen? How can God let this happen? And how can we somehow make it go away? And I've learned we can't. We can't. We know how to relieve suffering, at least a great deal of it. We know how to evade it. What's hard for us is to confront it when we have no power to make it go away. It would be great if we could truly end all suffering. I believe that. But I also believe it's impossible because it's just part of the human condition. Like war and genocide have been. Like getting sick and finding out our bodies don't work. Like growing up and aging. There's really nothing we can do about those things. Suffering is part and parcel of the human territory, and we can't really choose to make it go away. We cannot choose whether or not to suffer, actually. We can just choose how we're going to suffer. Well, Matt said this is the final Sunday of our worship series on hope in dying. And we're grateful that many of you have stayed in this with us and done the hard work and heavy lifting that comes with examining the topic of death and dying and suffering. And there's always people that are here for the very first time on a Sunday morning. And so we want you to know we're grateful that you're staying in the pew and haven't already said, "Whoo, I'm going to the happy church down the street." Sometimes we're really happy. But really, actually, I think we're a range of things. And here you can count that rather than answering a lot of questions, we choose to ask them. And instead of teaching a method to exactly find hope in dying, we have tried to instead affirm the feelings that are present, both spoken and unspoken, as we come face to face with life's endings. Instead of sweeping broken pieces, like of our art that crashed the very beginning of this whole series, instead of sweeping broken pieces into a closet over there to hide them, we have left the mess and slowly made our way towards a new design. And we've all witnessed this together as individuals in a community. We've been held lovingly by three among us, and we're grateful to them, Eric and Megan and Penny, who have offered us classes to help us through the paperwork that hold answers for us when our time for death comes. They've offered to sit with us and meet with us as feelings surface that we really want to learn more about. It hasn't always been comfortable and it hasn't always been easy, but in order to affirm our hope in God, we have had to walk through this valley of the shadow of death first. So my hope this morning is that we're going to be able to look a little more, one more time, and in this case, this week, possibly recall the circumstances that are going on in our own lives, our own stories of grief and suffering, and the stories of those whom we love, and see if it's possible to experience God, to end up trusting God, even though we feel that pain and suffering. And that's why we chose to turn to the psalm that was prescribed for this Sunday. The psalmist's ancient question is the same as our own. How can one possibly put trust in God when one's life is spent in sorrow? When, as the psalmist wrote, strength fails because of his misery and his bones are wasting away. How can one say, "You are my God," when you feel the scorn of all your adversaries, when you feel a horror to your neighbors, when you feel like you're a broken vessel? How can one even speak of the steadfast love of God when there's terror all around? And if you're anything like me, just hearing that word makes you think of this week and the news even. Plane crashes, communities at war, people being bombed and finding places to hide if they can with their children. When there is terror all around and enemies scheme together to take each other's life, how can we say, "You are our God"? Well, one way I found help this week was through the commentary that I was reading. And a man named Stephen Montgomery shared a story, and it was written right about this passage, actually. And he talked about how a pastor was doing a type of Bible study, and we're going to do some of this actually on Thursday night at Maundy Thursday. And it's called Lectio Divina, and it's a way to experience the Bible where you read a passage out loud and then you sit in silence and you allow to come up for you the word that comes up for you. And then you read it again and you sit in silence and you allow answers to a question that has been posed to rise to the surface. And you do that multiple times. Well, this was happening by about this very psalm. And after that second extended period of silence, a woman in this pastor's group broke the silence and said this about this text. "This text has AIDS written all over it." To her, that psalm seemed to describe in total detail the final years of the life of her own son, who had died many years previous in the 1980s of AIDS. His name was Carl, she said, and he was raised in the South. But upon entering his adulthood, he realized that it would be really difficult for a gay person to find full acceptance in his church and in his community in the South. So he moved to New York City, and he found a new community of friends there. Shortly before his death, Carl informed his mom that he had been keeping a journal over all of the process of his illness of AIDS, and that he wanted parts of his journal to be printed in the worship folder for his memorial service. And the part he wanted printed was all of the blessings that he had listed in his life. And these are the ones that he asked for. First, he said, "My family, all know and all are supportive." Second was, "My friends, they are my second family in New York." The third was, "My nieces and nephews, they are the children I will never have. I'm thankful their parents put fear and ignorance aside to allow me to make a difference in their lives." And finally, Carl wrote this, "God. God has given me the grace to accept the situation, the power and endurance to go on despite the effects of this treatment, and the wisdom to realize that God's got it all under control." How does a person like Carl count his blessings in the midst of all of that suffering, failing strength, ostracism, and finally, death at such a young age? Somehow, both the psalmist that Matt read for us and Carl were able to find strength and exert endurance that kept them going in the midst of the worst that life had to offer them. I think that the psalmist's method is grounded in his own realization that somehow God had upheld him in the past. God not only had been a rock and a fortress, but had redeemed the psalmist. That comes right before the passage we heard. This psalmist is no like blind acceptor person of the joy police who go around. You know those people who are the joy police. You just have to look on the bright side. This will all be over soon, right? He didn't just buy into that line. The psalmist asks really hard questions about the way God works and God's creating, since he is a believer, but he is in such grief. We might say that the psalmist was looking back in order to find a way to go forward into the future. Sometimes all you really need to do that is to somehow get in touch with how you are simply in God's presence, in the same room with God. When you realize that you won't be getting a miracle, And both of these, the writer of the Psalms and Carl, at some point realized no miracle was coming their way. Or when you realize your loved one really isn't going to ever come back. Or where you realize you really are going to have to go through all of these medical interventions and treatments if you're ever going to have children. Your pain is going to be chronic. It's not ever going to go away. Sometimes all you really need when you have those moments of realization is to feel that at least God is in the same room with me, the two of us sitting tucked tightly together on the couch. Just presence. In the same way that Carl could look back over his life and realize somehow that in his journal writing, God was with him, I think he realized God upheld him even in his death. Both of these men trusted God. They took more than an individual relationship, though, in order to make that happen. What I mean by that is it wasn't just between Carl and God or the psalmist and God. There was more. The great novelist Flannery O'Connor made this observation many years ago. She said, "You arrive at enough certainty to make your own way, but it is making it in darkness. Don't expect faith to clear things up for you." We always ask, what does Flannery O'Connor mean? I think she means it's not just enough to have blind obedience or to just have it between you and God. You have to live into the community. And both of these people, though they had been rejected by parts of their community, were also embraced. You see, faith does not occur ever in isolation. Despite the way our American culture promotes and affirms the individualism of us at every turn, faith is not just something that is private between me and God. It is, by definition, communal. But often our suffering propels us into that private place. See, that's what's really hard. Often our misery takes us exactly away from those who can care for us and accompany us in our suffering and in our grief. We, as a culture, and we started our series really by saying this, look on those who suffer in silence as pillars of strength. We say that about people. We give admiration to those who seem to put their grief behind them within the allotted 6-week bereavement leave and get right back to work. That's an illusion, of course. It's an absolute illusion, but it is a predictable illusion for a people who do not know how to suffer. We know how to relieve much suffering, and we know how to evade it. What's hard for us is to confront it with no power to make it go away. It's the line in Carrie's song, "I am the true container for all that I've lost." We can't make it go away. But rather than confront the suffering that is part of our lives, what happens is sometimes what we do is search for a way out. We search for an enemy. We search for someone or something that has done this to us and who must be stopped or must be blamed. That's a really good way of distracting ourselves. But it really doesn't ever work out. Remember the emotional quadrant if you were here earlier in our series? That's it up there. I'm just going to review it shortly. The emotional quadrant describes human beings and our feelings. See the big words: happy, sad, angry, and afraid. And our goal, we said then, and I'm reminding us, is to be emotionally resilient people who can go through our lives embracing joy as well as sorrow. In order to be strong and able to do that, We need to somehow find our way to live our feelings in all four of those quadrants. But so many of us end up stuck. And the way we get stuck is we take a feeling, the idea is that any feeling you can name goes in one of those boxes. Happy, sad, angry, or afraid. Come up with an emotion, and then it will fit in one of those. And the way that we get stuck is to say something like, well, I am just going to stay lighthearted about this. See, I'm up in the happy quadrant. I'm just going to stay lighthearted about this. I am not going to be sad about this. That is a waste of time. It's not going to get me anywhere. I'm just going to stay up here in the happy. But we get stuck in the happy because stuff ends up happening. Someone dies and we have grief. So where do we go if we haven't practiced sad or afraid or angry? I want to show you in another way. Good job. This is called a sphere. Not just any kind of sphere. Maybe some of you have seen this. And I found it really helpful when the teacher who was working with myself and Matt at the conference we went, she used this. This is called a Hoberman sphere. Hoberman's an architect. I'm not going to go into all that, but he's brilliant. You can Google him. Hoberman. Basically, when we are unwilling or feel unequipped to address and express our suffering or the full range of our feelings, what happens is we get stuck. And one of those quadrants can be illustrated by just this one ball. Okay, that's one quadrant. All of this, by the way, I should say, is going on inside of us most of the time. It's all internal. But really, our emotions can't be separated from each other. We cannot expand in our capacity to feel joy while we constrict or deny our experience of honest fear or grief. So what happens is, let's say you experience a death in your life and you're very sad about that. And that's all you can feel and it kind of goes in this sphere and you stay like that. But that's all you're going to feel right now is sad. But if you're feeling sad about that and you're willing to say, why am I sad? Well, I'm scared. I'm scared because the person that died was my dad and he always took care of me. It expands a little bit when you do that. Because you're a little more honest. And then you think, oh, well, the truth really is I'm sad because he died. I'm scared because he's not going to take care of me anymore. And I am pissed off because he shouldn't have died anyway. He was only 60-something. He just retired. We were just ready to have fun. See? We start to expand. And then, possibly, you can say, I'm so sad that he died. I'm really scared about what my future will be like. I'm angry because it shouldn't have happened, but I hear his voice, and he's telling me, I'm going to be okay. I know I'm crying, but really, it's healthy. This is what I do. And look at that. This is what we all do if we allow ourselves. But if we just stay, let me tell you, in one of those quadrants, most especially the angry one, that's what our life is like. That's what our life is like. And I think we see this and hear this in the case of Carl, who was willing to try and work on his emotions so that even in death, his life was like this instead of like this. ultimately, you see, it's not that we experience all of our emotions and feelings more intensely when we choose to allow them to surface, though that may happen. You just saw it happen with me. I let it come up and it gets intense. But what really goes on is, and you saw it, you don't all know me, but what really happened right there is I could actually get through saying all that, and I'm still standing here, and right now I'm not crying. But I still had all those feelings. And just to be fair, you know, my dad died over 4 years ago, so I've been working on this. And what that means is that our joyful emotions are the ones that actually end up becoming more intense. And they mitigate the pain and the suffering of ourselves and others. And I think we think that this may truly be the main path towards finding our own strength to confront suffering. So today, Matt mentioned it earlier, and I want to remind us that in the church calendar, there's a reason we have these palms. This is the day in which we remember that Jesus was greeted by the community with shouts of joy, happy, love, and the waving of palm branches to signify how important Jesus was to the community, the whole community. And this is why we mark this, to remember that part of our story. He was the Messiah to the people. And today is also then the beginning of the week in which we follow him from this parade of joy and love through his last sacred meal shared with his closest companions. That's what we're doing on Thursday night, is commemorating that. But then our next step is that we see that not everyone stays with him. And many in his community abandon him. And in that way, I think we see that many of his followers, like ourselves, when we feel powerless to make suffering go away, either someone else's or our own, we choose to ignore it. Only a few stay with him, a small remnant. But somehow, sometimes that's all you need. And the women were the ones who stood fast and were willing to face the suffering. So a question for us as we tie this series together is there any way that each of us can share our suffering and give thanks for our blessings? Like the psalmist, like Carl, like Jesus? Or will we choose to retreat from God, go and allow our suffering to make it individualized and private, and stay away and out of community, and sometimes even away from ourselves? I know that this psalm is full of many details of how bad it is to suffer. I know that many of us already know that. Yet winding through it in subtle ways is the confidence of the writer, the one who had great courage just to put it out there. His deepest laments were put out there. His hidden fears were on display. His private grief was recorded, not just on paper, but out loud with God. And in this, we witness one who chose to expand, I believe, not only his grief and his feelings and himself, but his faith. He chose to allow the full range of his feelings to reach the surface in hopes that he would somehow feel joy. And Jesus very soon is going to give us that same example of how to grieve and how to look to God for hope. And ultimately, it's not suffering itself, but it's our incapacity or our capacity to confront suffering that will allow us to deeply feel God's presence in our lives. The cross, you see it behind me, the cross may be seen as the main symbol of Christian confrontation with suffering. The cross we face every Sunday when we come in here. In some ways, the cross is the way of those who understand that suffering is part of life. Some of it is to be confronted. Some of it is to be endured. Some of it is to be gotten rid of. And what I mean by that is justice needs to happen so that unmerited suffering of the oppressed is solved by those of us in power. Carl didn't run from suffering. None of us can ultimately run from suffering. Jesus didn't run. He endured it with what seems to me like great pain, but also a deep dignity that comes through his story. One theologian says it like this, and this is my closing. At the cross is where we learn the truth that saves our lives, that suffering does not have to ever destroy us. It is our fear and evasion that do that. Suffering can make us indestructible by putting us in league with the crucified one whose own hurt battered the heart of God and broke through into abundant life. Because that's the promise. Abundant life. And the cross is what points the way. Carrie says it in her song, out on the curve of the earth is a hope that won't let go. God is present with us. We are present with each other. The question is, will we allow that? How will we choose to walk together?